Over 34 years and hundreds of races, the Breeders' Cup has provided many a thrill and many a great race. But virtually everyone agrees that one race stands alone, and that's the 1988 Distaff won by Percival Ensign. It may have been the greatest Breeders' Cup race ever run. This year marks the 30th anniversary of that race, and on today's Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, brought to you by TaylorMade, we'll look back at this great race with trainer Chuck McGahee and jockey Randy Romero.
For over 40 years, buyers, sellers, and breeders alike have turned to TaylorMade for custom-fit solutions. From boarding to breeding to both public and private sales, our dedicated team stands ready to serve you. With expert advice from the Taylor brothers and their experienced team of account managers, you can count on TaylorMade to provide the personalized service you deserve and expect. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing can do for you.
Welcome back. This is Bill Finley, the host of the TDN broadcast. Chuck McGahee was just 37 in 1988, and at least from the outside, he faced a ton of pressure coming into the 1988 Distaff. Not only was Percival Ensign the darling of thousands of racing fans, but she was trying to do something in the Distaff that no top horse had done in 80 years, retire with an undefeated record. And to do so, she had to beat a Kentucky Derby winner in Winning Colors. Somehow she did it, even though as the race was being run, it appeared impossible that she would run down the Derby winner.
Five lengths off the lead of Winning Colors, who turns for home here at Churchill Downs. Stevens going to a vigorous left-handed whip, holding on by two. Goodbye, Halo is charging hard. Here comes Percival Ensign, unleashing a furious run on the outside, but it is still Winning Colors. Goodbye, Halo. Percival Ensign, a 16th of a mile from the wire. Winning Colors is there. Percival Ensign, a dramatic finish, and here is the wire, and it is Percival Ensign there with Winning Colors in a photo.
That was a photo where Percival Ensign had her nose in front. Now, we welcome now Chuck McGahee. And Chuck, before we get into the Distaff, I want to go into some of the background of Percival Ensign. And people seem to forget that she was seriously injured as a two-year-old. She fractured her left rear pastern and had surgery that required five screws. I've read that you suggested that she should be retired at that point. Was that the case?
Well, I didn't suggest it, Bill, but I thought that's what we were doing, really. That was about the time we were going to she was breezing to go to the Breeders' Cup out in California. And when she hurt herself, so right after that, I went to California and Dr. Bramlage came up and went over to Dr. Reeves and operated on her. And when I got back, you know, I was just hoping everything went fine and we would, you know, she'd settle in as a broodmare. And when I got back, Dr. Reed came to me and said, you know, that filly will be fine. And I said, what do you mean she'll be fine? And he said, oh, she'll race again. So I promptly got on the phone and called Dr. Bramlage, and he said, yeah, she might hurt something else, but she's not going to hurt that ankle again. And obviously she didn't.
Well, how skeptical were you that they were right? That it would be one thing for her to come back, but that she'd come back and be a grade one level horse.
Well, if we hadn't thought she was going to be able to compete at the top level when I was getting her back ready to run again, we probably wouldn't run her. But she stayed in New York all winter, and, you know, a lot of that obviously was in the stall. And she came through it all the time, and everything we wanted to do, she did and answered. And then we started training her again, and, you know, she was going along. She looked terrible from being kind of in the stall and this and that. And even Mr. Phipps had said something to me about it. I said, well, I understand that, but let's see what happens when we start, you know, doing a little bit more with her as a 2-minute licking and breathing and stuff. And as soon as I started kind of picking up her exercise a little bit, she started putting on weight and her hair started looking the right, you know, her coat was good and everything just started coming together. And I pretty much got her ready to run at Saratoga. And you know, we were keeping a close eye on it, and but everything was good. And I remember I took her over the gate, but I better work her out of the gate one time. So I took her over the main track from Oklahoma to the gate, worked her in company, and my exercise boy there, who's a good friend of mine named Bob Witham, he was on the other horse, but he didn't know who Percival Ensign was. And so they came back, they worked out a gate and came back, and I said, "How'd you do, Bob?" He said, "Oh, I did fine." But he said, "Who's that other horse?" He said, "She worked really good." And I said, "Well, she's really good." And then she was eligible. I think I ran her out of conditions when we got her back there. And, then we got her going, and it was all history after that.
Mm-hmm. So if she had never run in the Breeders' Cup distaff, she probably would have gone down as her most famous race, having won the Whitney. So people forget also that she beat males. And why did you choose that spot? Did it have something to do perhaps with hoping to get Horse of the Year?
No, I think it was just something that we wanted to try, you know, just to see. She had won that year. She had won the Shoebie, and she had won the Hempstead. She'd gone down to Monmouth. She only wins at Belmont. I said, "Well, we'll figure that out." And I took her down to Monmouth, and she won the Molly Pitcher in pretty impressive fashion. And when we came back, it was just a matter of, where we're going to run her. And I think both Mr. Phipps and I were excited about giving her a try against the Colts. It's probably something that maybe I'd done a time or two before with no success. I remember I ran a filly called Duty Dance in the Man of War, but so it was just something if she was doing good, we wanted to give her a chance. And so that's how it came up.
Okay. So we get to the fall of 1998. You go in the Beldame, you win it for the second straight year. And now the storyline's set in stone. The Breeders' Cup distaff is going to be her last race. And if she wins it, she goes out undefeated, does something that no major horse has done in 80 years, and puts her – she was already going to be a Hall of Famer. She was already going to be a famous horse. But this was going to make her the type of horse that they build statues for. How much pressure were you feeling going into this race?
Well, I'm sure, Bill, I was feeling some pressure, and I know I was excited about it. I can remember that. But, she had won we'd beat Winning Colors in the Mascot, going a mile, giving her weight, 4-year-old against 3-year-old. Then we came back, we ran the Beldame, and I think he had 3 or 4 horses in there, Wayne did. And, I remember telling myself that she's better than these horses, and she breaks good. Just sit down and watch her run. And that's when she broke good, and I just sat down and enjoyed watching her run. Probably the first time that I'd really sort of enjoyed it. And so when we went to Louisville, everything seemed to be good. And obviously I was nervous. I had 3 or 4 horses running that day, so it kind of kept me busy. But I was nervous, but also was excited, and excitedly nervous. And then the weather came up bad, but the racetrack had a little bit of water in it when she won the Whitney. And so I really wasn't that worried about it. In hindsight, I think that probably the track didn't go to her suiting until, really she got into the race and got a hold of it the last part of it.
Sugar, as I recall, she also broke her maiden in the slop. So I know Churchill's a tricky track when it gets wet, but I can't imagine you had many fears about her running on a wet track for the reasons that we've just talked about.
No, I didn't, even though I know Churchill well. I knew it well. And I know it can be tricky. Some horses will like it even when it's fast track, and some don't. And I'd had a little bit of experience. Easy Gord gotten beat earlier in the day on a funny track where a horse had gone the lead and he wasn't able to catch him, and it looked like that was going to happen in the distaff with Winning Colors going to the lead and was skipping over that track, which is a track we knew that she liked because she'd won the Derby on it. And but as the race unfolded, it never looked good until the last jump. Anybody that's watched the race knows.
Right. Well, we will continue to explore one of the greatest races ever run, the 88 Breeders' Cup Distaff. But first, another message from our friends at TaylorMade.
Why do TaylorMade horses sell for nearly double the market average? A history of success, honesty, and hard work. For over 40 years, buyers and sellers alike have trusted TaylorMade as the industry's top source for high-quality thoroughbreds and friendly service. While sellers get top dollar for their horses, buyers are rewarded for top results on the track. From sale toppers to Grade 1 winners to Breeders' Cup champions, think TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing.
Chuck, you had not only had you already beaten Winning Colors in the Masquette, which we talked about, but Winning Colors' prep in the Spinster was not very good. It looked like the time that perhaps she was not coming into the race in her best form. What did you think of her as a competitor coming into the race?
Well, I agree with you. You know, I mean, we'd beat her pretty fair and square going a mile here doing what she wanted to do. And then she went to the Spinster and threw a real dud in. But, you know, Wayne's always had a way of horses bouncing back. And obviously she liked the sloppy track at Churchill, and she liked the track at Churchill. She was pretty much at home there. And, you know, she ran an outstanding race. But I don't think going into it that I was really that, you know, I mean, I was concerned, but I wasn't overly concerned, really, because we beat her, and then she had run such a bad race in the Spinster. So, you know, I think there were some others that maybe had my eye a little bit. Mm-hmm. More on her, including Goodbye Halo.
Sure. Chuck, all trainers at some point in their career have had 1-9 shots get beat, even the best. But with Personal Ensign, do you get so used to winning with her that it's almost like you don't expect to lose?
Well, Bill, it was kind of a funny thing because, you know, she broke her maiden and I ran her back into present. And then she was off. That was in October. Then she was off until the following September. And even though she trained good, you know, that race ended up turning up a pretty salty kind of a race. And so there was always the apprehension then of how she would do, and then off a layoff like that. And then when I ran her back, I think in the same conditions, because she had run out of condition. She was a 2-0 then, ran the 3-0 then. And I remember I was with Tommy Skiffington, who had a filly in the race, and he said to me, well, at least I don't have to run against her again. And I kept my mouth shut because I knew we were going back in the same race. And, you know, then she really exploded that day. And then she won that mile race against 3-year-old fillies that they don't have anymore, or maybe it's on the grass. And, you know, but then we came back into the Beldame, and, you know, that was against older fillies. So that was another new chapter in what we were going to do. And, she was able to do that. So it was never, you know, until really the Beldame of her 4-year-old year, it never was really a comfortable situation, even though, you know, I mean, I'd rather be 1-5 than than anything, but because they got something to show for it. And as you say, you can get beat just as easy as you can, but that's part of it too. But it was, you know, and then we decided not, you know, I think probably one of the reasons she had such a good 4-year-old year was that we decided to skip going to Hollywood Park when they had the Breeders'
right.
Cup, you know, it was like the 21st of November or something. And so Mr. Phipps and I, neither one, you know, said, let's put the stop to it. We've run 4 times here in, you know, a short period of time, and we'll bring her back. And then when we brought her back, I couldn't get a prep race to go for when I ran her in the Shoeby, which was a Grade 1, off a 6 or 7 month layoff. So obviously that wasn't a comfortable situation either. And, you know, then going into the Hempstead, I think that probably it was a little bit, you know, more comfortable because we'd come back and won, and then we were coming off of a race. And then, you know, then we went to Mama. She'd never run out of town. She'd never run over a different racetrack than Belmont. And that could possibly have been her first 2-turn race.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was questions there. And then, of course, we answered that. I mean, I knew going in she was the best horse in the race. It's just a matter of whether all the pieces came together. And then, you know, then obviously the next time we ran against the Colts. And so, you know, and it rained. And so I was, you know, sort of didn't know what the situation was going to be there running against the Gulch and King Swan. And, you know, it was kind of a, they kind of rode her out that day out in the middle of the racetrack. In fact, she was almost out past the crown, but she was able to pull away at the end and win. So then we come back into the Masquette, and I had not planned on winning colors being in there. So I think it was either run there or run in the Ruffian, and the Ruffian was a handicap. So I elected to take, to go in the Masquette where we would get allowance condition weight, which I think she carried 122 or 123. But I had not expected winning colors to be in there. So I put Cadillacing in the race also. I was going to use her as a rat a little bit. And I came into the paddock for like the third race, and Cadero was going to ride Cadillacing. And he told me that Wayne wasn't all happy about Cadillacing being in there. And so I said, okay, well, I'll scratch her. And then if you watch the race, I mean, she broke and was about five in front and ended on a 16th of a mile. I remember thinking, I said, well, you made a mistake here. But I happened to watch the race on my phone just the other day. And, you know, she picked him up and pretty quick. So, you know, none of those, even though she was short priced, there was always a hitch to it.
Right, right. Right.
And the Derby winner is Loose on the Lead. It's winning colors now, and she's opened up by 4.5 lengths.
So let's get into the distaff itself. And what you just heard was Tom Durkin's call as they're about halfway down the backstretch. Winning colors is going easily on the lead. And Personal Ensign, well, she seemed to be spinning her wheels. At that point, were you worried? Were you worried before then? What did you think as winning colors was 3-4 in front and seemingly going comfortably down the backstretch?
Well, I was never really comfortable because she got back farther than she usually does, even though she came from back. And then you know, like we got to the half-mile pole and nothing was happening. And she used to start kind of picking up her horses then, and then it's a 3/8 pole. I was standing with a friend of mine, and he kind of looked at me, and I kind of looked at him. I said, "Don't look like it today." And then all of a sudden, you know, then she started making that run. But you know, winning colors was still comfortably in front, and you know, I was still at the 8th pole. I didn't think she was going to be able to catch her. I just wanted to make a good account of herself, and then bam, she did catch her, but Randy told me it was never in doubt, so
right.
I had to go.
Right. I don't know about never in doubt, but okay.
No, I don't know what he was thinking about, but it was, you know, that was a race there, Bill, where trainer didn't have anything to do with it. Jockey didn't have anything to do with it. That was all horse, you know, mm-hmm. She just wanted to win, and that was why she was 13 for 13.
Right. Right.
Personal Ensign is still 8 lengths out of it. There's a half mile to run, and winning colors doing what she did in the Derby. She's still free running on the lead. 3 furlongs to run, and she leads now by 3.
So after the race was over, and to no surprise, you told who the NBC, whoever was the commentator, I forget who it was, that you thought she was quote-unquote hopelessly beaten. So did you underestimate her determination? Was she even – she have even a bigger heart and an even bigger will to win than even her trainer knew?
Well, I think so, to see something like that, you know, for her to run down the – she ran down the Derby winner and the Oaks winner to win. I mean, I don't know that you ever know that they've got that much determination, because really in most all of her other races, she was kind of winning fairly easy. And, you know, so it's hard to measure, you know, that kind of heart unless they showed it to you. And she obviously showed it, that day.
Mm-hmm. Shug, you won plenty of big races, many Breeders' Cups. You won the Kentucky Derby, you won the Belmont Stakes. But I wonder if the overall career of Personal Ensign and how you guided her through a surgery, 13 races undefeated, pulling off the impossible in the Breeders' Cup, something that nobody thought could be done at the 8th pole, at the 3/16th pole, just like you said. Where do you rank this whole story so far as your top achievements as a trainer?
Well, I think it's the top. You know, I mean, like you said, if she was the first champion to be retired undefeated in 80 some odd years, and I don't think there's been one since. And, you know, it would have been a shame if she'd have gotten beat that day after all she'd done. But, you know, to be able to have a filly and to be able to participate in those type of races and have her win as many of them as she did, or all of them, you know, was something that's, you know, a career maker. And, you know, I think that a lot of the awards and stuff that I've gotten have been because of, you know, her career. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's very satisfying to me to look back on it and, you know, think that we all went through that together. And I've got Joe Hirsch years ago gave me a poster that I've got framed in my office of all of her 13 races, you know, and I'll sometimes walk up there and look at it and just kind of look at the charts and see who she ran against and that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, still exciting, mm-hmm. exciting for me. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, I never have watched the replay that much. I mean, I remember, you know, that's the next summer, like we were at Saratoga, and every time you turn the TV on, they'd show the finish of the race. But as of me sitting down and watching the rerun that much, I haven't, because it's, you know, it's still kind of scary to relive.
Right.
But I read one time where Neloy had put Nashville or somebody on the train at Aqueduct, and he said he hated to lose him. I said, well, the personal incident, I hated to lose her, and there was a big hole in the stable because mm-hmm. of that. But I think we'd done all we could do.
Certainly. Well, a great training job and a great career. And again, one of those races that we may have to wait another 100 years to see something like that again. And we may never see something like that again. So, Shug, thanks so much for your time. And congratulations on all you accomplished with her in a Hall of Fame career. And we'll catch up with you again soon.
Okay, Bill. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much to Shug McGahey. And we'll be speaking to jockey Randy Romero next. But first, this message from TaylorMade.
And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
Over the past 4 decades, TaylorMade has risen from a small boarding operation to the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing. Here's Hall of Fame trainer Jerry Hollendorfer.
TaylorMade sales follow many horses that are training at the racetrack, and they are particularly adept at evaluating mares and placing them with a proper stallion after their racing careers are over. They are very straightforward and are also experts on confirmation of younger weanlings and yearlings.
My name is Tia Andrini, and I am from San Mateo, California. I've been doing business with TaylorMade for about a year now, and it's been one great experience after another. It started with my first TaylorMade venture when I bought an interest in the filly Catherine Sophia, which ultimately landed me 3 weeks later in the middle of the winner's circle of the 2016 Kentucky Oaks with her. The TaylorMade team is a group of truly outstanding individuals. They are knowledgeable, professional, and completely customer service driven. To me, the TaylorMade name epitomizes the term trusted advisor. That is exactly what they are, and I am very proud to be associated and doing business with them.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
We welcome now Randy Romero, who was aboard Personal Ensign in 12 of her 13 races and was, of course, aboard her in the Breeders' Cup. Welcome, Randy. And before I get into the race, I want to start by playing a clip of something you said after the race.
I was getting a little worried, but I didn't get discouraged in my filly. I know she makes a hard run, and I knew from when I got to the 70-yard pole I was going to get her.
Now, you just told the people on NBC that you thought you had it won in the last 70 yards or so. Randy, there were 71,000 people at Churchill Downs that day and millions more watching on TV. And you may have been the only one who thought Personal Ensign would actually catch Winning Colors. Why? What did you know? What did you sense or feel that told you she was going to pull off the impossible?
Because I rode Winning Colors when she broke her maiden. And I always knew she came up late. And the way the track was, Gary had opened up a lot of lengths on the field, and the field was spreading. So I knew it was going pretty fast. The timing wasn't fast, but the track was muddy, but it still made it going fast. And I had rode her, and I knew she'd get late at the end, so I just never give up on her. Mm-hmm. And I could see when I switched my stick to my left hand at the 3/8 pole, or the 5/16 pole, that she got on a hard surface, and she started picking up horses. And the last 16th of a mile, I could feel her accelerating to get to that filly. I had passed by a Koa, and she thought it was over. But when she looked over to the other side and she saw Winning Colors, she was brilliant, this filly, this mare. Mm-hmm. And she looked over and saw her. She dug in again. And that's why I used to ride quarter horses, and you know, with inches and foots and stuff like that. I rode one of the best quarter horses in America. They made the movie Casey Shadows. So when you ride quarter horses, you know when you can win and not, even though it's mm-hmm. inches.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Randy, I want to get back to that point you made about when you made that shift out to the middle of the track, but let's save that, because that was a very interesting and critical point in the race. Even though she won, she just never looked like herself until maybe the final 16th of a mile. And was it strictly a fact that she just wasn't getting a hold of the track? Was there anything else going wrong with her that day, or was it really just a matter of she just didn't like the footing?
She did not like the footing, but she had so much heart, and she wasn't going to give up. And she was a mare that she'd fight until there was no end, and which I knew that Winning Colors gets delayed at the end of the race because I had rode it that one time. So I just never give up on my mare. And I kept on riding her.
Personal Ensign is putting her run in on the inside now, and she takes to the outside. 5 lengths off the lead of Winning Colors.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, and people who get a chance to go back and watch the race, at about the 3/8 pole or so, maybe a little closer to the quarter pole, you were down on the inside, and then you shifted out to about the 5 or 6 path. And that really seemed to be the pivotal moment in that race. What was going through your mind? Why'd you make that decision to get off the rail and go to the middle of the track?
It's an instinct that made me do it. I don't know why I did it. It's just an instinct that I had to do something because I wasn't getting anywhere where I was. So something in my mind just made me switch stick and hit her left hand. And then when I did, she drifted out. Mm-hmm. It was just like an act of God that it happened. I don't know why I did it. And people ask me that all the time. And it's just an instinct that I had to do something. And there was nothing that I was doing that was correct. So I decided it just came to my mind to do it. And it was getting to the way I wasn't gaining any ground. And then I needed to get after her and get ground picked up. And that was the pinnacle move.
Right.
And that's what made her win the race.
So you believe if you stayed on the inside, she would not have won?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. It's interesting that I had always thought that was part of your plan. It's very interesting to hear that you just sort of did it by instinct without even thinking about it.
No, it was an instinct.
Okay. Okay. Randy, I asked Shug the same question. You were on the hot seat. This filly was looking to do something that hadn't been done in 80 years, to retire as an undefeated horse, of a top-caliber horse. And you're the guy that asked to get her to the wire first. How much pressure were you feeling that day?
Well, when they announced, Tom Jerker announced that she'd be the only filly in history to go in, one of the only horses in Florida undefeated, and I got all these people looking at me. I wanted to go underneath the gate. I was feeling a lot of pressure on me. And I was pulling up, and I says, "Do you think you won?" I said, "I did. And I'm glad this is over." She was one of a million. I mean, I know there's a lot of good mares that run since, But she would fight until there was no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
She was dedicated. She was something special. And I got to give Suge credit. He managed her to perfect T.
Absolutely. Randy, you sort of answered this, but I wanted you to elaborate on this. You said one in a million, and probably in this race, only one in a million horses could have pulled this off. What, besides, you know, the obvious of that she's fast, you know, you've got to be a fast racehorse to be able to do this, but what traits made her perhaps one of the greatest horses alive, or a horse that could win a race in what literally looked like a sure defeat?
She had the inspiration. She had the drive. And she wouldn't take no for an answer. And she was gritty. And there's one in a million like her. And hey, I'm going to tell you what. The first time I ever rode her, I just come to New York, and I had rode for Lish Navy, and his time was a lot faster. But after I get off, I come back and I broke her maiden. I told Suge, this is the fastest horse I ever rode. And he says, really? Better than Polis Navy? I says, absolutely. Mm. And he had to run a faster time, but I never let her run a bit.
Right.
I mean, everything was in hand. I mean, she went by so far that why beat her up? And in all of her races that she run in, I never beat her up. And if she could win just by a length or two, I'd let her win by a length or two. But I never did open up because I wanted to conserve her because I knew that she was that kind.
Right.
So I wanted to save her for all the races that she could run. You know, more pounding on a horse is what breaks them down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she had a broken back leg already as it was. So I protected her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Randy, before we let you go, a lot of people are aware that since you retired, you've had a lot of personal health issues, particularly with your kidneys. Can you bring us up to date? How are you feeling these days, and is everything under control?
Well, I was on the list for 6 years now, and I got off of it. And if the good Lord wants to take me, I'm ready to go.
Okay.
I'm not going to go to no more. I was going to New Orleans every weekend almost, and they never wanted to do anything. So I decided just to leave me alone and live the life I have. And the good Lord wants me, and let him take me.
Okay.
I'm not going to go through more suffering anymore.
I understand. But to hear you talk now, you sound great. I mean, there's only so much I can tell from listening to your voice. But are you feeling okay? Is a normal day?
Yeah.
Good.
There's just little problems. I had that little problem today, and I'm hurting like a sumbitch right now. I'll tell you that. But, you know, it's all the time for somebody, it's a big circle. It's, you know, you play your cards, and I rode well. I rode hard, and I got hurt. I had 38 surgeries with the one today. I'm a fighter, and I'm going to keep fighting as long as I can, but I'm not going through no more surgeries.
I hear you.
For my liver and a kidney.
Right, right.
It's just too much on me.
Right. Randy, congratulations on not only what you did with Personal Ensign, but of all the accomplishments through one of the great careers in the history of modern racing. I want to thank you for coming on. I want to thank Suge McGahee as well, and also our sponsor, TaylorMade. And let's thank Personal Ensign as well, because she gave the sport some of the greatest thrills that any of us have ever seen. Randy Romero, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. You have a good day.